Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic podcast, episode 4, The Civil War Continues.
In our last episode, we went over Rise of Mithridates. We also covered the first half of the Civil War, and we brought us up to a point of Sulla taking control over Rome. He marched on Rome. He had forced the young Marius back to Praeneste. Metellus and Pompey were giving it to Carbo hard.
To Sulla's credit, he landed in Brundisium pretty outnumbered. Even though, from what the histories say, Cinna and Carbo really failed to do much to prevent his return, and they could have done a lot more to prepare for his inevitable return. And we see that the odds start to slowly slip towards Sulla's favor as he is joined by the rising star on the scene, Pompey.
Okay, so Sulla starts his march on Rome, and all of the cities on his route open their gates to him, and he enters the capital unopposed. He ends up camping his army on the Campus Martius, and he begins to seize all of the property of his opponents.
I want to do a little geography here. The Campus Martius, and I want to get into more of the city geography as the need arises, but the Campus Martius, also known as the Field of Mars, was more or less an assembly ground outside the boundaries of Rome, west of the Tiber River. And if you look at a map of Italy now, the Tiber runs just west of the city. We've mentioned it was illegal for a commander to bring his armed forces into the city. The Field of Mars made a convenient place to assemble voters or troops and that like. So
Mars being the Roman god of war.
Yeah, in ancient times it was probably, from what we understand, probably swamplands or marshlands. It was drained by one of the earlier kings of Rome and used for the purposes mentioned. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting to think about the implications of the religious aspects of the Field of Mars. You know, the Pontifex Maximus, you know, that still exists, as the Pontifical College of the Roman Catholic Church. That institution was in play here under the pagan reign of the Roman gods, it's theorized that the Pontificus Maximus and the Pontifical College were actually a bridge builders, and they would dedicate each separate bridge to a certain god, and that's how they began their religious aspects. They were bridge builders. You know, all the different locations in Rome have a lot of religious significance. If you've ever been to Naples, or Rome, you know, you'll notice that there's churches everywhere. A lot of times you'll see small little altars recessed into the walls of, alleys or little side streets. You'll see little shrines or altars to saints. And that's probably a lot of the way things were done back when there were multiple deities being worshipped. So it's really interesting, to kind of understand that the geography is, and the political landscape is really bound with the religious institutions that were going on at the same time. But anyway, we were talking about Sulla, and he was plotting his three-pronged attack. He had just confiscated all the property of his opponents and put it up for auction, and he after was now plotting Rome, his next move.
Right. Yes, and after taking Rome, the war effort moves north.
Right. The Marian forces were located primarily in Tuscany, Umbria, and the Gallic lands south of the Po. You know,
this is the area known, you'll hear in your ancient sources, as the Po Valley. Obviously the area between Gaul, which is present-day France, and Italy Major. The area in between, as I said, is known as the Po Valley, and it technically now, if you look at the geography now, it would be part of modern-day Italy, but this area was considered more or less a province. Like, they had governors of the Po Valley, so it was properly modern-day Italy, but was considered part of Gaul.
Exactly, and so you had Sulla was in Rome. He was planning on marching north to advance at into the stronghold at Colusium, which was where the Marian resistance and Carbo was held up. Pompey was to march southeast from Picenum and meet with Crassus and join Sulla at Colusium, while Metellus was to sail up the Adriatic coast of Italy, taking the area of around Urinatus, which was a really strong wheat producing country around Ravenna. He was going to seize Ravenna as well.
Ravenna is the city that Caesar launched his campaign from when he eventually marches on Rome and when he crosses the Rubicon and that sort of thing. Ravenna is one of the nearer cities that are just outside the boundaries of Italy proper. So.
Right, and you know, if you've ever been through the area and up and down the Adriatic coast, you'll notice that it's very flat. And it would be very easy to sail up and down the coast versus, you know, the terrain in Tuscany or Umbria, which is more hilly. And as you go farther south in Italy, it becomes more mountainous. So that's kind of the geography there. So basically, Pompey starts marching from his hereditary estate in Picenum to meet Sulla. Carbo starts engaging Sulla immediately with his cavalry, and a battle ensues on the river Galenus. And later a battle is fought to basically a stalemate between Sulla and Carbo near Clusium. Pompey meets with his what will become his lifelong rival, Crassus, and they end up marching to a Umbrian town called Spoletium. Here's what Appian writes about this encounter. In the plain of Spoletium, Pompey and Crassus, both Sulla's officers, killed some 3,000 of Carbo's men and besieged Carinas, the opposing general. Carbo sent reinforcements to Carinas, but Sulla learned of their movement and laid an ambush for them and killed 2,000 of them on the road. Carinas escaped by night during a heavy rainstorm and thick darkness, since although the besiegers were aware of some movement, they made no opposition to account for the storm.
So Pompey's left a little disappointed that some of these men that he wanted to conquer were able to escape by night. But he does make up for it by defeating a relieving army sent by Carbo himself of 8 legions. So this is a force quite a bit bigger than the one Sulla landed with in Brundisium, modern day Brindisi. And according to the histories, Pompey slaughters a great deal of these guys. So this was a pretty tremendous victory. The rest he surrounds and engages in siege warfare. Unfortunately, the encamped army escapes by night by leaving their campfires lit. It's a classic ploy, and Pompey is a little embarrassed to fall for such an ancient ruse.
Right, because at this point, Carbo was attempting to send Marius, who was still holed up in Praeneste, he was attempting to send him 8 legions to reignite the southern campaign, to be able to divide the Solan forces, which are now launching this 3-pronged attack in the north.
And despite inferior numbers, to Sulla's credit, he is really starting to take the lead in Italy. Better generalship seems to be leading the day with Pompey and Crassus. And though Pompey never becomes known for extreme military conquest, from what we do have of his military exploits, he was a pretty successful general. And now with the loss of Sertorius, which we mentioned in the last episode, the Marian chances of prevailing are starting to lessen. And we'll understand what a loss this was to lose a commander like Sertorius, and probably the next chapter. And I'm just going to add that the odds, however, suddenly reverse as 70,000 Samnites, left over from the social war, suddenly turn and march on Rome. And
right. And the Samnites were really the last tribe to stay, one of the last tribes to stay fighting in the social war, and they were never included in the final terms. They really had hopes that the Marian regime was going to support their independence.
Now, was that animosity from Rome, or did they not abide by the laws to register themselves?
Well, there was always a large hatred between the Romans and the Samnites. You know, the Samnites were known for kind of being barbaric. They would supposedly run raids on areas like Pompeii and Herculaneum, and kind of these resort towns that Rome had started setting up in Campania. They were known for, you know, like shaving their pubic hair in public. That was one of the things that was kind of a turn off of them. But they basically, Rome had a series of wars called the Samnite Wars, because, you know, where they attempted to reduce these kind of mountain raiders that would come out of the mountains and attack these resort towns of Rome. So basically the Samnites never really wanted to be included in the Roman plan. And there's a lot of animosity between the Romans and the Samnites.
We're talking about these Samnite wars dating back to 300 BC. The second Samnite war was in 326 BC, or from 304 BC. So pretty bitter wars with the Samnites.
Right, because, you know, there's a time when there were what was known as the Latin Wars, where basically Rome was expanding from a small city-state into the surrounding countries of Latium. To the south, and they were really starting to conquer and take over a lot of these Latin tribes. And from my knowledge, the area that the Samnites occupied was a little further south, and it's a little bit more mountainous in that area. And so Rome, as Rome began to grow, it ran into these Samnites who never really they continued to resist. And I think that's a kind of a trend that we see with Rome not really able to take over completely very mountainous areas because of the partisan tactics. You know, you can't really wage very good warfare like the Romans like to wage. These areas are really conducive to, guerrilla warfare, guerrilla tactics. You know, we see this in... Absolutely. We see this in Germany in the early imperial phase. You know, we also see these, Rome succumb to these guerrilla tactics, you know, in Illyricum, kind of in the north of Illyricum, in Macedonia. You know, even though the Via Ignatia, which was the road that stretched from Dyrrhachium, all the way into, Macedonia, all the way to the east, even in Cicero's time, he still says that, you know, the Roman power and the Roman sphere only extends as far as the sword in that area. So basically they were still having to fight. Sulla was having to fight, troops from Macedonia, and Thrace on his way back from the east when he was coming to basically sail and start the civil war. He was still fighting, tribes there. So, you know, these Samnites were kind of, in tribes that had never really given up inside of Italy itself. And what Carbo was doing at this time is he was really trying to relieve Marius at Praeneste, because he needed to have someone in the south to reopen that theater in order to split the troops of Sulla. The Samnites were noticing all of Carbo's failures, because Carbo attempted at least three separate times to relieve Marius at Praeneste, and Sulla just kept intervening. He kept being able to sack these troops, and prevent these troops from, really reaching Marius. And he kept checking Marius, and his attempts to leave, Praeneste. They started marching. Sulla hears that 70,000 Samnites were on their way to Praeneste to try to relieve, Marius. And, he marches to intercept them, and he's actually able to, hold them and Marius at bay. So originally these 70,000 troops were held at bay, and when they failed to liberate Marius, they decided to march on Rome. Here's what Appian says about that. Sulla feared for the safety of the city and sent his cavalry forward with all speed to hinder their march, and then hastened in person with his whole army and encamped beside the Colline Gate near the Temple of Venus about noon, the enemy being already encamped around the city. A battle was fought at once, late in the afternoon. On the right wing, Sulla was victorious, but his left was vanquished and fled to the gates. The old soldiers on the walls, when they saw the enemy rushing in with their own men, dropped the portcullis, which fell upon and killed many of the soldiers and senators. But the majority, impelled by fear and necessity, turned and fought the enemy. The fighting continued through the night, and a great many men were slain. The generals Telesinius and Albinus were slain also, and their camp was taken. Laponius and Lucanian, Marcius and Carinus, and the other generals of the faction of Carbo fled. It was estimated that 50,000 men on both sides lost their lives in this engagement. Prisoners to the number of more than 8,000 were shot down with the darts by Sulla, because they were mostly Samnite. The next day, Marcius and Carinus were captured and brought in. Sulla did not spare them because they were Romans, but killed them both and sent their heads to Lucretius at Praeneste to be displayed around the walls. You know, and I think what kind of confused me when I first read that was that, Sulla was commanding on the left wing.
And Crassus was commanding on the right. And the story we have from Plutarch and a few other sources is Sulla had reached Rome in the nick of time via a forced march of his men, who showed up late in the afternoon, exhausted, as you said. And apparently his left wing collapses, where Crassus' side on the right actually prevails. And when Sulla begins to think all is lost, he randomly gets word from some of Crassus' envoys requesting food and rations for the night. So here he thinks the battle's lost and Crassus' men are looking for dinner. And he realizes that Crassus had prevailed and saved the day. And we don't see Pompey in this battle, which has become known as the Battle of the Colline Gate, because he and Metellus were tactically held up by Carbo and 30,000 men and were not able to aid Sulla and Crassus in the Battle of the Eternal City.
Right, and basically what happens here is we talked about the heads being sent to Lucretius at Praeneste of Marcius and Carinus, who've been pretty consistent officers of Carbo. And once the heads are noticed by the Praenestines, they surrender, and Marius, who is basically hiding in some kind of underground tunnel, commits suicide. Wow. So basically Lucretius now comes into the city, and he cuts off Marius's head and sends it to Sulla. And Sulla famously remarks, "First learn how to row before you try to steer," which was kind of, it's interesting because here we have,
ironic.
Here we have a couple, Sulla, who's actually using Pompey, who's 23 at the time, Crassus, who's, I'm not sure, he's fairly young as well, but, he's basically just killed the equivalent of the Marian Pompey, who he's really championing and sneering at him for being young and unskilled. It's kind of hypocritical of Sulla, but I think it also shows kind of what desperation, these families were in, what kind of desperation Sulla was in. That they're now relying on such young individuals who would normally be scoffed at and sneered at.
Yeah, and Pompey, being 24, 25 at this time, wasn't even old enough for the most junior senatorial rank. So he had no legal authority to even command an army. And we'll see in our later dialogue that Sulla was probably fundamentally opposed to Pompey's extraordinary and already in his early 20s, has a pretty extraordinary career. Sulla is probably fundamentally opposed to this, but what more choice does he have? And the icing on the cake of the Battle of the Colline Gate was, after the victory, news came to Rome that Pompey had broken free, massacred 20,000 men in the process, Carbo, our good friend Carbo, who's now despairing of constant defeat, constant defeat, loses heart and has plans to flee to Africa. And I did want to take a moment to discuss this in the podcast. Carbo loses heart and flees to Africa, although there are still many, many troops in Italy that are Marian sympathizers. As you said, Marius is out of options. Did you say he commits suicide?
Yeah, he basically commits suicide at Praeneste, and his head is sent back to Sulla, and then those remarks are made. And then we have Carbo and Norbanus. Yeah, they are attacking Metellus in a place called Faventia. Basically, Norbanus, that consul that was with, Scipio at the very beginning of the war, he's defeated and loses 10,000 men. One of his officers, named Abiniovanus, defects, to Metellus. And, Abiniovanus is basically, then he reappears to Norbanus and invites all of Norbanus and, Norbanus's, officers, Gaius Antipater and Flavius Fimbria, who's the brother of the Fimbria that we dealt with in Asia, who basically the Senate sent to Asia to try to steal the Mithridatic War from Sulla. He basically invites them to the feast. You know, Norbanus is nowhere near this, probably fearing for his life, Gaius Antipater and Flavius Fimbria are murdered at this feast that Albiniovanus sends. And upon hearing this, Albiniovanus then deserts with 6,000 men. And upon hearing this disaster that takes place at Armenium, Norbanus doesn't know who to trust and he flees. So the last remaining consul, basically flees to Rhodes, and he later kills himself, when Sulla recalls him. But, after hearing this, Armenium and a lot of other camps start defecting to Sulla. And you also have the Gauls who inhabit that country between Ravenna and the Alps that the Po Valley went over to Metellus en masse, we're told. And Lucullus, who's one of the main legates of Sulla, now ends up winning a victory over Carbo's forces at Placentia. And basically all of these things fold into Carbo, the reason for Carbo losing so much heart. You know, you have one of the consuls basically killing himself and is beheaded. You know, you have Norbanus, who was a previous consul. He flees because he was betrayed and all of his officers were killed. And then you have, all of the Po Valley going to Metellus, in mass, we're told.
No, and he could have done a little better for himself. Probably, this is probably mostly hindsight, but, he could have done a lot better to ally Sertorius with his cause. Sertorius is probably, I would argue, the most able general at the current state right now in the world. And this is going to be very obvious in the coming chapters. Why he seemed to alienate himself from Sertorius, I'm not sure, but from what we understand, it wasn't a great loss to him that Sertorius up and left. He was a little tired of the criticism. Sertorius had lost all hopes of a Marian victory when he flees to Spain. And he wasn't seen as a big loss to the Marian sympathizers because of his, I guess, his naysaying. He wasn't very happy with the way things were being managed, with the way things were being done. A lot of opportunities Carbo throws away. And to Pompey's credit, we said that he massacres 20,000 men and eventually makes it to Rome. And before that, him and Crassus are able to subdue 8 legions. And since the biography is about Pompey, I want to comment on that, because I hear over and over by modern biographers, they de-emphasize his ability as a general. And here we have a 23-year-old man who's outnumbered, inexperienced relatively, and he has some pretty stunning victories here in his early years that are pretty lost to history, and really because they just don't compare to his future exploits.
And I think also what is kind of lost, in a lot of the biographies that I've read and we've read, is that you know, he had a large amount of clients, clientelia in his family. You know, specifically from the Po Valley, you know, from Sicily, you know, from a lot of different areas, that aren't explicitly mentioned, but we have to assume that because his father was active in these areas, he probably had, connections through his hereditary, through hereditary clientelia. So he's actually commanding, a great number of forces, that are fighting for Rome at this time. So basically at this time, after Pompey, defeats these, you know, this 20,000 men around Colusium, Carbo starts to flee, to Sicily, and him and some of his officers fleeing the country.
So the war on the Italian peninsula, seems for the time to have finally quieted down. And it's during this time that Sulla makes an attempt to bind Pompey with his faction, and he proposes a marriage alliance with Pompey. And this is a little, this seems a little shady from how the history records it, but Pompey divorces Antistia, whose father was found dead floating in the Tiber, and whose mother committed suicide because it was such a shock. And he marries Aemilia, who unfortunately dies. She's already pregnant with her husband, who she divorces, and she has a miscarriage and dies shortly afterwards. Now, Aemilia would have been Sulla's stepdaughter. Her mother would have been Metella, married to Sulla, whose previous husband was Marcus Aemilius Scaurus.
Yeah, Scaurus. Yeah, we've talked about Scaurus before. He was that individual who was fiery guy that prosecuted all the bribed military men during the Jugurtha War. So, you know, that is kind of the hereditary lineage that she has, placing her directly in the Metellus family and binding Pompey to the Metellus family, the most powerful family in Rome at this time.
That's our main note on that marriage alliance, you know, poor Antistia.
Right.
Certainly. And Aemilia,
and we went over this in the last episode too, you know, that at this time, Sulla basically had to divorce, his wife, on her deathbed, Metella, who is the wife of, Aemilia. He basically in trying to maintain his connections to the legitimacy of the Metellus family, the Metelli family, he nominates Metellus Pius as the Pontifex Maximus, which is a position he's going to hold for the next 25 years, which is humongous. And Sulla basically gives Pompey to the Metelli family at this point. And that's kind of how I feel this is going. I don't feel that Pompey really had a lot of self-determination in making this decision of divorcing Antistia. I feel like...
Well, a lot of the contrast, I think, comes from... I mean, and like I said, it is pretty shady, but a lot of that contrast comes from Caesarian supporters, because Caesar was married to Cornelia, who was Lucius Cornelius Sinna's daughter, and history has it that I think at one point Sulla tries to pardon Caesar, who was probably about 18 or 19 at the time, maybe even younger, and Sulla's willing to let him go because, you know, being the son-in-law of his sworn enemy Cinna, Caesar refuses to divorce his wife Cornelia, which, you know, refusing the will of the soon-to-be dictator Sulla is not a good medicine for long life. So there is that.
Right, and we're told that also, you know, this is before Metella is divorced from Sulla, but basically Metella is sharing the wish of Aemilia to marry Pompey, and they basically both Sulla and his wife persuade Pompey to divorce Antistia and marry Aemilia, and this would bring Pompey and all of these clientelia of his father in the Po Valley, which is a huge wheat producing area, and probably Sicily, because remember Strabo was a governor of Sicily. And, you know, he probably had a lot of hereditary clientelia, in that area. The Metellus, you know, from Metella Numidicus, controlled a large amount of, you know, had a lot of hereditary clientelia in Africa, which was also one of the overseas grain, producing areas along with Sicily, which made up the, you know, the two main overseas grain producing areas. They also, had a great deal of hereditary influence in, Macedonia from Metellus Macedonicus. So really at this point, the Metellus family was really the, basically the masters of the Roman expansion.
So in Pompey's defense, divorces were as commonly had then as they are now, for better or for worse, and it wasn't uncommon to divorce just to climb the social or the political ladder. And for a man like Pompey with relatively obscure origins, he was probably pretty desperate to cultivate the legitimacy of some of these leading families. And we'll see in several marriages to come that he is trying to seek that that level of dignity and legitimacy. We've already talked about the large amount of power that a political alliance can have via marriage. So in his defense, I'm compelled to defend Pompey a little bit with that. But then, of course, we have the headstrong Caesar as a teenager at this time, flat out refusing the orders of the dictator Sulla, or the soon-to-be dictator Sulla. So as things start to stabilize in Rome, Sulla apparently has some debts to settle with his opponents in Rome. Do you have anything to add here? I guess we're going to go into the prescription, the Temple of Bellona meeting, which I love.
Right. So at this point, Sulla basically makes himself master of Italy and basically has himself proclaimed as the dictator of Rome. He was basically now seeking to reward his officers, and specifically the officers that made the biggest impact in the Civil War, you get the biggest lion's share of the rewards. And, you know, maybe you can lead us through, a little bit of what happens here. Obviously, Pompey gets probably the lion's share of the reward by marrying into the Metellus family, which is the most powerful family in Rome.
Do you want me to get into some of Sulla's reforms here?
We could get to that in a later episode if you want. Okay. We could also go into, basically at this point, Pompey gets, he now has a small standing army, and Pompey needs to basically keep him occupied, as well as trying to hunt down Carbo, who is now actively attempting to raise troops in Africa and Sicily.
Well, I guess we can get into the reforms, but Sulla does issue the prescriptions, which I do want to mention briefly. Okay, so Sulla returns to Rome. His family and his clan, his friends, did not fare well when he was off in Asia. We mentioned the purge of Marius in earlier episodes, but Sulla takes us to a whole new level. If Sulla could have had any chance of going down in history as a just or talented leader, it pretty much ends with the famous prescriptions in Rome, where he basically prescribes his chief political opponents, even friends of political opponents, and him and his supporters start to indiscriminately kill and massacre, usually for a reward.
Here's what Appian says about the prescriptions of Sulla. Sulla now busied himself with slaughter, and murders without number or limit filled the city. Many, too, were killed to gratify private hatreds, although they had no relations with Sulla. But he gave his consent in order to gratify his adherents. At last, one of the younger men, Caius Metellius, there's Metellus again, made bold to ask Sulla in the Senate what end there was to be of these evils, and how far he would proceed before they might expect such doings to cease. We do not ask thee, he said, to free from punishment those whom thou hast determined to slay, but to free from suspense those whom thou hast determined to save. And when Sulla answered that he did not yet know whom he would spare, well then, he said, Metellus, in reply, let us know whom thou intendest to punish. This Sulla said he would do. Some, however, said that it was not Metellus, but Pufidius, one of Sulla's fawning creatures, who made this last speech to him. Be that as it may, Sulla at once proscribed 80 persons without communicating with any magistrate, and in spite of the general indignation, after several days' intervals, he proscribed 220 others, and then on the third day, as many more.
And we have another chilling story that, while in the Temple of Bellona, Sulla was addressing the Senate, now the dictator Sulla. The Temple of Bellona, let me go back. When I mentioned that the state and the religions were not separate entities, more or less, in Rome, the meeting of the Senates could be done in the Senate House or in various temples. The temples served as political offices or meeting places of the Senate is what I'm trying to get at. So at one point in the Temple of Bellona, Sulla is addressing the Senate, and the Temple of Bellona is cleverly close to the Circus Maximus, which was basically a racing coliseum or a racing amphitheater that can hold something like 250,000 men. And inside the Circus Maximus, Sulla has some 6,000 Samnites, which were prisoners of war, led in there. And he has them massacred in the Circus Maximus, which is close enough to the Temple of Bellona that the senators in there, in an act of intimidation, are able to hear these Samnites screaming as they're executed. And Sulla famously is annoyed that the senators seem bothered by this, and it's a pretty good scare tactic if it's true, and it probably was. So in 82, Sulla sends Pompey to Sicily, which is probably good news for Pompey because, A, from what we understand about Pompey, he wasn't a bloodthirsty tyrant. His career, thankfully, is not overly tarnished with indiscriminate slaughter like the proscriptions. So he gets his first legal command, and he's given the Praetorian authority, and he is sent to Sicily in 82 to fight Properna, who we'll hear about, who's the governor of Sicily, and who fled along with Carbo, who had just arrived. Now, during these proscriptions, I know I need to back up a little bit, our man Crassus that we learned about ends up becoming the richest man in Rome before Pompey comes back from the east and Caesar from Gaul eventually. And it said that Crassus makes a lot of his fortune during these proscriptions by buying up the properties at very, very cheap rates. And he becomes a very famous and very wealthy land developer. Another man named Sergius Catilina, who we will absolutely hear about in further episodes. I know I keep suspending all these stories. Is said to have made a pretty large fortune by getting the bounties on the heads of some of these equestrians and senators and people that are prescribed in Sulla's massacres. Anyway, Pompey leaves for Sicily. Carbo and his lieutenant were picked up by ship, and Carbo was spared for questioning. So whatever Carbo was trying to do, he lands in Sicily but decides to leave, and then he's picked up by some of Pompey's lieutenants before he's able to mount any sort of resistance. Apparently, and this is a pretty sordid story, Pompey has him executed straight away, and his head is sent to Rome. And it's a pretty bad story because apparently Carbo was really distraught, crying like a woman, that's what the books say, and was asked to relieve himself before he was executed. So the 24-year-old Pompey executes a man who was three times consul and outranked him. And this is one of the things that really start to blacken Pompey's reputation. But, you know, in all fairness, there really wasn't another alternative for Carbo. Pompey really couldn't have risked sending him away or sent back in chains. So some of this aggression we see from Pompey with these executions are probably at Sulla's behest. And at any rate, he starts to earn the reputation as the boy butcher. What's the Latin for that?
I don't know. I think it's Carnificius juvenatus or something like that, or adolescence.
So Pompey is giving this reputation as being the boy butcher for his execution of Sulla's opponents who he sent out to fight. But Plutarch warns us, however, one must be very careful about believing everything that is said when dealing with the enemies of the friends of Caesar. It was a matter of necessity for Pompey to punish those of Sulla's enemies who were most important in themselves and whose capture was generally known to have taken place. With regard to the others, he allowed as many as he could to get away, and in some cases actually helped them escape. One must admire also his conduct with regard to Himera. The city had sided with the enemy, and Pompey had decided to punish it. And I'll paraphrase that story, that Pompey had invaded a city that had allegiance to the Marian cause, and one of the chief citizens came out to greet Pompey, and he basically said, look, I led these people to do this, spare their lives, you know, take mine, long story short. And Pompey was pretty moved by this, and he pardoned the whole city. We have another story where Pompey invades another city, another resistance of Marian sympathizers, and these people foolishly start quoting to his army the laws of their city, forbidding them to enter, and Pompey says famously, do not you quote laws to us, we carry swords.
Then I think, you know, with the proscriptions, you also get the rise of Cicero, who is, you know, right now he's just going through training as an orator and a lawyer. And I think it's really interesting to look at what's known as the trial of sex. Basically this man has his father Roscius. And his father was a client of the Metelli. And after his death, his name is kind of inserted into the proscription list by one of Sulla's freedmen, Chrysonicus, yes, who consequently brought up his estate at an incredibly low price. And when Roscius attempted to right this wrong, attempts were made on his life, and he consequently sought refuge in the house of Calicia Metellia, the daughter of Metellus Bellericus. And this kind of illustrates the client system and kind of how the families worked. You know, he was now seeking refuge in the patron family of the Metelli. And in defense of Roscius, together with the necessary but dangerous attacks on Chrysonicus, this defense was entrusted to Cicero. So Cicero became basically a defense attorney for the Metelli. And this is going to be very important because now basically Cicero starts portraying the Metelli as specifically Calicia Metellia as virtuous, dignified, you know, basically just keeps giving her these grandiose, you know, very powerful, you know, descriptions of her goodness and faith. And this is basically ingratiating himself into the Metellus family.
It's a pretty big risk. It's a pretty big risk to Cicero's personal safety. Cicero, who was born in 106 BC, is an exact contemporary of Pompey. And to his credit, for a man who's often been accused of cowardice, Chrysonicus was one of Sulla's favorite freedmen, a slave that had been free and given his liberty by Sulla. So defending a case against him was probably, again, not a very smart medicine to live a long life. But Cicero, who was known to be one of the cleverer lawyers in Rome, to paraphrase, basically compares Sulla to Zeus, and basically says, well, the actions of this man are not Sulla's doing. Just like if Zeus were to, or if Neptune were to stir the waves in all the ocean, if one boat sinks, that's hardly Neptune's knowing or doing. Some pretty clever stuff there, and
but I think the main point that I think this illustrates in the context of Pompey is it starts to ally Pompey with one of the soon to be most prolific orators in Rome, and later on, you know, Cicero will be comparing himself to Laelius and comparing Pompey to Scipio. And this is, they really become a political team, you know, just like we saw Marius and Saturninus, Marius and Sulpicius. You know, Pompey becomes the general on the frontier, and Cicero becomes the orator in Rome, representing the Metellus family, but specifically Pompey.
And that's no exaggeration. In Cicero's letters, which thankfully he's left some about 1,000 letters, a personal correspondence between him and other leading statesmen, namely his friend Titus Pomponius, or better known as his name, Atticus. So Cicero ironically becomes one of the chief contemporary sources of the time by a chance of his letters being preserved. And we have in those letters him referring to himself as Pompey's Laelius, as Scipio's Laelius. And in some of his famous dialogues that do come down to us through history, on his treaties on friendship, he famously uses the characters of Scipio and Laelius to express his dialogue. So it's no exaggeration that he's a big fan of the general and statesman Laelius and Scipio. And folks, that is all the time we have for today. Join us next time, and we will talk about Pompey's campaigns in Africa and triumph. You've been talking with Alan Keith and Luke Murphy.